prayer, hiding themselves behind holy pictures and crosses, but then fire at our people again whenever they can. Who can blame our people for feeling bitter and using harsher methods? Lance Corporal Carl B., also with the 2nd Panzer Division, wrote after the campaign, "The Polish soldier is the most vile creature there ever was in war. They hardly ever took prisoners. Whoever fell into their hands was bumped off in the most gruesome way, and we gave the Polacks the same brotherly treatment. The poorer areas the soldiers passed through seemed especially to justify their anti-Slavic attitudes further. You can see the Poles never bother to repair anything," wrote Private Hans W. of the 73rd Infantry Division, a second wave infantry division that was part of Army Group North's reserves coming down from Pomerania. "You recently wrote to me about finding work here in Poland," wrote Franz F. to his fiancée. "Honestly, don't bother. It's literally filthy here. All modern conveniences like running water, electric light, gas, and so on are missing entirely. A town like Łódź, with 600,000 inhabitants, doesn't have a single sewer. In most streets, you see all the human waste chucked out. One should be mindful that German soldiers might have chosen to depict Poland as a human pigsty in order to impress their readers. And by no means all German soldiers held the Poles in contempt. On 9 September, just before crossing the river Weichsel, Captain Friedrich M., also of the 73rd Infantry Division, recorded in his diary, "Whole caravans of trucks with Polish prisoners are being brought back, and there's also a continuous stream of returning civilians. Now they've seen that we aren't barbarians, that we won't do civilians any harm, they return home with their kids and with all their possessions in a pram." 3 days later, with the honesty a private diary allows, he bemoaned the damage German soldiers had inflicted upon the local school. "A microscope lay broken on the table, a projector screen lay cut up in the corner, the lovely library was torn asunder, and cellos lay destroyed on the ground." It is clear, nonetheless, that many German soldiers did regard Poles with contempt, and were accordingly more likely to handle them roughly or worse. This alone was not enough to impel them to kill their prisoners. The fighting conditions they encountered during the campaign also played a role. It goes without saying that neither motive justifies killing prisoners, but when they fused together, they helped to explain the troops' behavior. For one thing, the vast majority of German soldiers were tasting combat for the first time. Their inexperience made them jumpy and excitable, but above all, it made them more likely to react badly to losses. The temporary blows that the Poznania army landed on the Germans riled them especially. Moreover, the Polish forces disintegrated so completely that the Germans captured more prisoners than they had expected or could provide for. For instance, on 8 September, 7 Corps, serving under Army Group South, reported that more than 6,000 of its prisoners and internees were without supplies. Given the derision many German soldiers felt towards Poles, nervous German guards faced with overwhelming numbers of Polish POWs were more likely to maltreat them, or in isolated cases, shoot them. On the night of 5 September, for instance, German guards in the prison compound at Serok panicked and shot 84 prisoners. Allegedly, the prisoners had been attempting to escape, though it is unclear whether this was the case. German soldiers advancing through the Polish corridor felt further cause to despise Polish civilians and military personnel. Here, German troops came into contact with Poland's ethnic German population. Ethnic Germans comprised 3% of the country's populace, and had suffered considerable discrimination and economic disadvantage during the interwar years. Then, on the outbreak of war, reports, real or imagined, of ethnic Germans carrying out sabotage against the Polish army led to many of them being arrested, deported, or shot out of hand. In the Polish corridor, Polish troops killed around 1,000 ethnic Germans. The same Captain Friedrich M., who was capable of sympathizing with Poles, railed against the outrages to which ethnic Germans had been subjected. According to the father of an ethnic German family with whom he had been billeted, the worst agitators were the Polish Catholic priests, and thanks to their agitation, many gruesome murders have been committed, the worst of which was in Bromberg, where so many Germans have lost their lives. He then told me of the days of hardship, and I rarely saw what these people have had to endure. Then his father-in-law arrived and told me how the Poles had locked him up and wanted to use him as a hostage before the Germans broke in and freed him. Ethnic Germans greeted the arriving troops with enormous relief. They were indescribably happy at our arrival, wrote Franz F., a purser with 13 Corps, to his fiancée. The Germans here have really suffered, but have held on wonderfully despite 200 years of their culture being suppressed or persecuted. I have managed to find myself a really small girlfriend, a 10-year-old blonde called Irena. She is so good and well-behaved that I share all my meals with her. The exact number of ethnic Germans whom Poles killed is unknown, but probably runs into the low thousands. Appalling though these actions were, however, they were nothing like as massive and systematic as Nazi propaganda pretended. They were more spontaneous outbursts of brutality inflicted in a dangerous, violent wartime situation against a section of the population that was suddenly being viewed, however rightly or wrongly, as a nest of fifth columnists. And while these circumstances did not justify the Poles' behavior towards the ethnic Germans, neither did that behavior justify the infinitely larger, more methodical campaign of murder, terror, and oppression to which the Germans subjected the Polish civilian population both during and after the invasion. On 16 September, General von Brauchitsch issued an order that saddled the entire Polish army with the blame for the atrocities against ethnic Germans. The behavior of the Polish army against defenseless ethnic Germans is to be made known. Such an enemy is capable of any perfidy and deserves no consideration. Thus did the Germans direct their ferocity not just at Polish POWs, but also at Polish civilians. Among other things, they often plundered with impunity. For instance, 7 Corps reported a case of armed robbery in which more than 5,000 zlotys worth of jewelry was stolen. On 20 September, General von Rundstedt entreated his troops to rein themselves in. I know that you will agree with me that every means must be used to prevent the great achievements of our troops being soiled by the behavior of irresponsible elements. Polish civilians, anxious to resist the mercilessly swift invasion of their country, frequently took up arms against the Germans. The most we've had to deal with are underhand, cowardly attacks by civilians, or rather soldiers dressed as civilians, wrote Josef B. on 9 September. At the beginning, the plague of sharpshooters in trees was rather irksome, but now we get stuck in energetically against such riffraff. A month later, Carl B. recounted, we suffered a lot at the hands of civilians. They would shoot us in the back. An old lady of between 60 and 70 cut the throats of two of our soldiers during the night. I could give you plenty of examples of how vile the Polish people are. Even though the details may sometimes have been luridly exaggerated, attacks on German troops by Polish civilians undeniably took place. However, although these attacks clearly flouted the rules of war as stipulated in the 1907 Hague Convention, the ferocious German reprisals were severely disproportionate. The wording of the convention did leave the Germans some leeway for harsh reprisals. Article 43 stated that an occupying force must ensure public order and safety and respect the laws of the land, unless absolutely prevented from doing so. On the other hand, Article 50 stipulated that victims of any reprisal must be shown to have some connection with the attack. Yet here the convention was ambiguous, because it depended upon a commander's view as to whether there was a connection. More ambiguous still was the 1929 Geneva Convention, which forbade collective reprisals against POWs, but said nothing about civilians. During the interwar years, most military establishments regarded reprisals as a last resort, but not as something that was prohibited. In August 1939, however, Hitler issued a much more emphatic directive, circumventing international law and identifying 4 offences by occupied civilians that were to be punishable by death: espionage, hostile acts committed by civilians, violations of German military regulations, and undermining of German military power. The German military also paid markedly less attention than the military establishments of Britain, France, and the United States to non-lethal alternatives to hostage executions. Over the course of the war, different commanders across Germany's occupied territories would inflict reprisals with varying degrees of ruthlessness or restraint. In Poland, however, the stress was definitely on the former. This was due not just to anti-Slavism, to the army's belief that pacifying occupied territory was vital militarily, or to the deep aversion to guerrilla warfare that generally characterizes conventional armies. For German military thinking was particularly vehement in its view that campaigns were fought and won by the clean-cut, decisive method of destroying an enemy's conventional army through skillful maneuvers and open combat. By definition, then, civilians who continued to fight outside of conventional hostilities or supported efforts to do so were heinous transgressors. German commanders had employed unusually harsh counterinsurgency measures since their experience of sharpshooters, franc-tireurs, during the Franco-Prussian War of 1870-1871. This was an approach that their experience of irregular warfare in more recent wars had reinforced. Most infamously, German troops had suppressed the Herero uprising in German southwest Africa with a ferocity that historians have frequently described as genocidal. During their invasion of Belgium and northern France in August 1914, German units were seized by franc-tireur psychosis, retaliating against irksome resistance from retreating Allied troops and isolated potshots from civilians, many instances of which were actually friendly fire from other German troops, by committing grand-scale arson and killing around 6,000 non-combatants. The fact that Austrian troops invading Serbia and Russian troops invading East Prussia that same month acted with comparable abandon does not diminish the appalling nature of the Germans' conduct. There were more measured precedents on which the Germans in Poland could draw in 1939. In the German-occupied Ukraine in 1918, for instance, some officers recognized that winning the population's hearts and minds was a better way to defeat insurgents. But in Poland in 1939, Nazi ideology and anti-Slavism led the German army to invoke harsher precedents. Thus, for instance, Army Group North decreed, "If there is shooting from a village behind the front, and if it proves impossible to identify the house from which the shots came, then the whole village is to be burnt to the ground." Its troops went on indiscriminately to torch villages in the Polish corridor. Army Group South's 8th Army also exacted indiscriminate collective reprisals. Often, a few shots fired by Polish soldiers defending a hamlet was all it took to push edgy German troops into committing brutal reprisals against civilians. One of the harshest proponents of counter-terror was Lieutenant General Max von Schenkendorf, commander of 35 Corps. General von Reichenau, Schenkendorf's immediate superior, ordered his units to shoot 3 Polish hostages for every German soldier killed by civilians, and 3 for every act of sabotage. Harsh as this order already was, Schenkendorf radicalized it on his own initiative, ordering 10 hostages shot for every German soldier killed. Overall, 16,000 Polish civilians had lost their lives to German reprisals by the campaign's end. Even on 10 October, after the campaign had ended, the new office of the Oberbefehlshaber Ost, senior commander in the East, declared, "The land has in no way been fully pacified. Countless former Polish soldiers who have avoided capture roam around the land and could become a serious danger for the security and order of the land, particularly under fanatical officers. Weapons lie in abundance around the forests. Every attempt at sabotage or defiance is to be suppressed with the harshest measures." The army's efforts to pacify its newly won territory also led it extensively to condone, indeed approve of, the even more pitiless measures the SS employed to bring the Polish population to heel. The SS dealt out these measures in the cause not of security in the conventional sense, but of decapitating all potential sources of future Polish resistance. Thus, while fighting on the front line was ongoing, the SS conducted a shadow campaign of selective killing behind the lines called Operation Tannenberg. 5 Einsatzgruppen, task forces of the security police and SD, were each allocated to one of the field armies. They targeted and murdered members of specific leadership groups within the Polish population, particularly the intelligentsia. They also targeted and murdered large numbers of Polish Jews. For this task in particular, they enlisted the eager help of ethnic German auxiliaries. Then, on 17 September, the Red Army invaded eastern Poland, seizing that portion of the country to which the terms of the Nazi-Soviet Pact entitled them. The German army was happy to see the SS expel Jews along the German-Soviet demarcation line, pushing them into the Soviet-occupied Polish zone and thus enabling the German authorities to wash their hands of them. The Red Army's attack left the Germans with little more to do in a campaign that they had virtually won already. Only Warsaw remained. With callously utilitarian calculation, General von Rundstedt decided to spare his troops a prolonged urban battle and instead ordered the Luftwaffe to bomb the capital into submission. Rundstedt's actions displayed two things that aligned the officer corps with Nazi thinking: racial contempt for the Poles and the technocratic ruthlessness that had characterized the officer corps since the First World War. The Polish campaign ended, a few stubborn pockets of resistance aside, when Warsaw surrendered unconditionally on 28 September. "It's emphatically over in Poland," wrote Lance Corporal Heinrich G. of the 73rd Infantry Division. "This campaign was carried out at such breathtaking pace that one can scarcely believe it was possible. It also clearly went too quickly for the English and French. You really have to take your hat off to the active troops." Karl B. of the 2nd Panzer Division concurred, recording on 7 October, "We had days when we advanced 50 to 100 kilometers, 30 to 60 miles. We were so dusty that we no longer recognized ourselves." There was also euphoria among the generals, several of whom were promoted, and several of whom, including Guderian and Höppner, were decorated. General of Cavalry von Weichs wrote that the exhilaration of knowing that we actually have the best armed forces in the world had banished all his doubts about the new army's quality. Lieutenant General Hans-Georg Reinhardt, who commanded the 4th Panzer Division in Poland and would go on to Army and Army Group Level Command on the Eastern Front, described the campaign as the crowning glory of my life as a soldier. All this was to ignore the many flaws in the German army's performance, not least that of Reinhardt's own 4th Panzer Division. Nevertheless, the bulk of the Germans' wider operational manoeuvres had been successful. Over the following months, the German army would set about the task of addressing the defects that the campaign had exposed. This would markedly improve the army's performance during its triumphant campaign in the West, against opponents far more formidable than the Poles. Equally far-reaching for the German army's future development was what happened behind the front lines, both during the campaign and in its immediate aftermath. Around 7,000 Polish Jews were murdered during SS operations in 1939. By December, the SS and its ethnic German auxiliaries had also murdered over 40,000 non-Jewish Poles. Such actions were increasingly assuming the character of a full-blown campaign of ethnic cleansing, all in the cause of Hitler's blueprint for an enslaved Poland under German racial domination. However, killing on the scale that was now unfolding transgressed the limits of what many German army officers were prepared to condone. Numerous senior commanders protested to General von Brauchitsch. One protest came from an army group commander, General von Bock. General von Schenkendorf, who had readily executed civilians in reprisal for guerrilla attacks, was appalled when he witnessed the SS murdering Jewish women and children. The most prominent protests came from Colonel General Blaskowitz, freshly arrived from the Protectorate as the newly appointed Oberbefehlshaber Ost. The deeply religious Blaskowitz was revolted by what was taking place, and initially refused to believe that Hitler was aware of it. He tried to open channels to the Führer in an effort to bring the atrocities to his attention. In the event, Blaskowitz's temerity not only failed in its objective, but also ignited an explosive response from Hitler, who castigated the army for its Salvation Army methods. Blaskowitz then went for broke and issued an impassioned and prophetic condemnation. "When high officials of the SS and the police call for atrocities and brutalities and publicly praise them, then, within the shortest spell of time, only the brutal will rule. With astonishing speed, men of the same sick leanings and character will come together in order to give full vent to their beastly and pathological instinct." Other officers tried pragmatic arguments. Whether they were only thinking pragmatically or just arguing pragmatically because they expected their superiors to ignore their moral objections is impossible to know. In any case, officers expressed their fear that the killings might affect the image of the German army in the Polish population's eyes, and that witnessing the killings might affect the discipline of its troops. That German army officers were concerned about the Polish population's feelings may seem surprising, but however much disdain many of them may have felt towards the Poles, officers did distinguish between harsh pacification measures to cow the population and wanton brutality that could only alienate the people and rekindle resistance. Thus, for instance, did the 10th Infantry Division order that all cruelty against the population is to be avoided, but all means of rapidly breaking resistance are to be ruthlessly employed. As for the troops' discipline, this was something officers had good reason to fear for. For one thing, anti-Semitism unsurprisingly found fertile ground among the German army's rank-and-file troops. It is impossible to know how many soldiers were involved in humiliating and tormenting Polish Jews during and immediately after the campaign, but there was certainly enough going on for commanders to become concerned. For soldiers already infused with anti-Semitism, the distinctive dress and hairstyles of Eastern Jews made them particularly visible targets. One soldier from a mountain troop unit, which fought in Galicia during the military campaign, later recalled the following scene. "It was a Saturday, and they presented themselves in front of us with caftans and little round hats. Many of them had shaggy beards, but it was their bad luck, for a schoolhouse in which we were quartered needed cleaning." Favorite methods of humiliation included forcing Jews to scrub the streets on their hands and knees and cutting off their beards. In Radomyśl Wielki, soldiers of 7 Corps put Jewish and Polish inhabitants in the church. The Jews were forced to spend the night there, while the German soldiers enjoyed themselves tormenting them by standing outside and repeatedly firing off shots into the air. 2 days later, the Jewish men had their beards shaved off or cut off by German soldiers in the marketplace. They were also forced to chew the grass between the paving stones and pick up rubbish with their hands, while German soldiers beat them constantly. Such behavior was by no means universal. Younger soldiers had been through particularly intensive anti-Semitic conditioning through the Hitler Youth and the RAD, as well as the army. Moreover, as far as governmental systems went, the Third Reich was all they knew. So it was hardly surprising if many of them accepted its tenets and acted accordingly. Their taste for tormenting Jews, or worse, was likely, therefore, to be stronger than that of their older comrades. One Polish eyewitness reported after the war that German army soldiers had behaved well towards Jews, and that, although they had not generally mingled, he did know a case of Jews inviting German soldiers to a wedding. Unusual as this example was, it demonstrates the danger of overgeneralizing about the treatment ordinary German soldiers dealt out to Polish Jews. Yet while some senior army officers tried to intervene against the killing of Jews and of non-Jewish Poles, others, such as 4th Army Rear Area Commander Major General Walter Bremer, actively supported the campaign, believing it would help keep Polish territory pacified. Brochich, supine as ever, failed to respond to such protests as were made. The most he was prepared to do was issue a directive in December ordering German soldiers to safeguard their discipline by maintaining a proper bearing towards the occupied population. When it came to what constituted indiscipline, Brauchitsch grotesquely placed needless sadism towards civilians on the same level as more mundane vices. Lack of activity and quiet times lead to the temptations of alcohol misuse. Drunken officers are as unacceptable in war as in peace. But the most important lines were crossed during the first week of October. On the 4th, Hitler pardoned all excesses that German personnel had committed during the campaign. 3 days later, he appointed Himmler to the post of settlement commissar for the East. This assured the SS the central role in reordering Poland along Nazi racial lines and prompted Himmler to reveal that the Führer himself had ordered the killing of Jews and other elements. Invoking Hitler's name was a sure way of stifling army opposition to the killings, for in the political power play of the Third Reich, no career-minded participant was likely to condemn publicly measures sanctioned by the Führer himself. Senior army commanders were also likely to limit their criticism for fear of sullying a military triumph in which they had been so instrumental. Then, on 17 October, Hitler removed the SS and police from the army's jurisdiction. 9 days later, the Transitional Military Administration was replaced by a permanent territorial arrangement. Two western Polish areas were converted into provinces and directly incorporated into the Reich, together with individual smaller parts of western Polish territory. The rest of German-occupied Poland was renamed the General Government of the Occupied Polish Areas. Over the course of the next 4.5 years, German-occupied Poland became both laboratory and graveyard due to the Nazis' efforts to reorder their newly conquered territory according to a racial grand design. Poland would undergo colonization by German settlers. Its native Polish population would endure terror, deportation, and exploitation on a scale greater than any other European country the Germans conquered. Among other things, Poles resident in the territory newly incorporated into the Reich were shunted into the general government to make way for ethnic German settlers from other parts of Europe. The general government also became the location of overcrowded, insanitary, ghettoized areas into which Polish Jews were crammed en masse. By 1939, the Reich's official preferred solution for dealing with the Jews in its realm was to get them to emigrate. But the war's outbreak rendered mass emigration unfeasible. Meanwhile, the spate of conquests that commenced with Poland brought more Jews into the Reich's fold. In other words, the scale of the Nazis' Jewish problem grew just as their preferred solution was closed to them. Nor was it possible, as the Nazis were about to learn in occupied Poland, to ghettoize Jews for any duration. The manpower needed to pen them in was not available, and chronic overcrowding within the ghettos threatened not only outbreaks of starvation within them, but also outbreaks of disease that might reach beyond their boundaries. From 1942, a series of extermination camps would be established on Polish soil, and Poland would thus become the main setting for the final solution of the Jewish problem in occupied Europe. Under the occupation arrangements of October 1939, the army was empowered merely to conduct military operations in the interests of security. It therefore lost any remaining chance it might have had to curb SS actions in Poland. In one respect, however, the army itself was active in Poland's racial reordering, as it devised plans to settle German veterans and their families as armed farmers along an eastern wall in Poland. Brauchitsch used the idea as something over which the army and SS might cooperate, and thereby repair the damage that had been caused by the confrontation over the SS killings. Himmler was receptive to the idea of some kind of security zone. He suggested an enormous tank ditch to be built using Polish Jews as forced labor. He believed he could sell the idea of the ditch as a policing measure against smugglers and spies, and also use the need for Jewish labor as a further argument for the Jews' mass deportation. However, in February 1940, Hans Frank, the head of the general government, who wanted to be saddled with as few deported Jews as possible, prevailed upon Hitler to water down the plans. The German army did not wholeheartedly support Nazi crimes during and immediately following the Polish campaign. However, its leadership failed to support the protests that numerous officers made. As for the army's rank and file, decades of anti-Polish animosity and a barrage of Nazi propaganda and army instruction, not to mention a heady sense of triumph at the army's first victorious campaign, made many soldiers, if by no means all, regard Poles and Eastern Jews with derision or worse. This atmosphere made it easier for Nazi propaganda and for the army's own orders to exaggerate the outrages ethnic Germans suffered at Polish hands, and to decry the attacks armed Polish civilians made on Wehrmacht troops. The resulting contempt that the troops felt extended both to Polish military personnel and to enemy civilians. Polish POWs and civilian reprisal victims perished as a result. All this took place against the backdrop of a German campaign that was ideological as well as military. It aimed not just to defeat the enemy's forces in the field, but also to subjugate, oppress, and exploit an entire racially inferior civilian population. The SS, not the army, was the main instrument of this endeavor. However, so preoccupied was the army with its own security needs, and so spineless the posturing of its commander-in-chief, that it largely complied with it, a course of action further eased, of course, by the anti-Polish sentiment that permeated the army. Thus, in all these respects, did the Polish campaign lower the moral threshold of what the army leadership and many other officers and soldiers were prepared to acquiesce or indeed participate in. Not all officers and soldiers embraced this development as readily as one another. How readily could be determined by such things as their age and whether or not their ancestral home lay within Polish territory. But admirable cases of outright opposition, most prominently that of the conservative Christian General Blaskowitz, were too few to be effective. Militarily, the Polish campaign showcased the superiority of the German army's tactics and training, particularly in mechanized warfare and its solid grasp of operations. Nevertheless, it was not the sternest test of the German army's capabilities. In Poland, the German army faced an isolated, outnumbered opponent with nowhere to run, trained and equipped to standards markedly lower than its own. Even then, pugnacious Polish defenders managed to expose the German army's ongoing shortcomings. The spring of 1940 would present the German army with a much more formidable challenge. However, the aftermath of the Polish campaign would enable it to scrutinize its performance afresh, augment its strength, and surmount the military challenges of 1940 to spectacular effect. Chapter 4. Sitzkrieg, 1939-1940. The 7 months between the outbreak of war and early April 1940 saw the Allies and the Germans steadily build up their forces along the frontiers in the west without any aggressive action. For the troops, it was a static and tedious period experienced under the grim conditions of the northwest European winter of 1939-1940. The British called it the Phony War, or alternatively the Boer War, the French the Drôle de Guerre, the Funny War, and the Germans the Sitzkrieg, meaning the Sitting War. As far as the German army was concerned, however, these months can be viewed another way. They saw the army undergo a vital upgrade in which it augmented its strength and intensified its training. The army, together with the Luftwaffe, also united around a plan that in May and June 1940 would knock France out of the war and Britain out of the continent. Before that, in April 1940, the army would participate with both the Luftwaffe and the Kriegsmarine in an operation in Scandinavia that would see them totally outclass the Allies there. The Franco-German frontier was lined by the forts of the Westwall on the German side and by the Maginot Line on the French side. The Maginot Line extended in strength from the Swiss frontier to just south of the frontier with Luxembourg, whereupon it became a string of weaker fortifications running just south of the Franco-Belgian border. North of that, the British and French aimed to support and coordinate with Belgian and Dutch armed forces. For while Belgium and the Netherlands were still neutral, that would of course change should the Germans attack France through the Low Countries. Such was the apparent ease with which the Germans scythed through the Allied opposition in May and June 1940 that it is all too easy to overlook how evenly matched the two sides were on paper, and the trepidation with which the Germans viewed the prospect of attacking in the West. Hitler held the French in lower regard than his generals did. He wanted to attack in November 1939, and suspected that Brauchitsch and Halder were bellyaching merely to delay an offensive. This was indeed what Brauchitsch and Halder were about, though they felt they had good reason. After all, the memory of the German army's previous attempt to defeat France hardly inspired confidence. They considered their regular active divisions superior to those of the French, and were unconcerned about the amount of resistance the Dutch army might offer against any attack the Germans made towards France through the Netherlands. However, they also considered the French army's artillery superior to their own, that the small, freshly assembled British Expeditionary Force, BEF, was of high quality, and that the Belgian army would offer ultimately ineffective but initially ferocious resistance. Nor did assessing the state of their own troops ease the general's state of mind. Among other things, Brauchitsch and Halder fretted over the shortage of regular officers for the newly activated divisions, and Brauchitsch bemoaned the serious indiscipline and lack of offensive spirit displayed by a number of infantry units in Poland. Both men were concerned about the lack of training of a number of specialist technical personnel. They were also right to fear that the autumn mud and winter snow would nullify the Germans' mobility if they attacked too soon, marring them in a replay of the trench warfare of 1914 to 1918. At this particular stage in the war, Hitler was not sufficiently confident in his military abilities to assert himself uncompromisingly, and he accepted the general's advice to postpone the offensive until the spring. The agreement that Brauchitsch and Halder won from Hitler was the sole occasion on which Brauchitsch actually stood up to his Führer. Such was the potential fallout that Brauchitsch directed army officers to avoid nourishing rumours of enmity between Hitler and the party, on the one hand, and the Wehrmacht, particularly the army, on the other. But the delay enabled the German army to make the vital advances on three fronts, material, operational, and tactical, that would enable it, together with the Luftwaffe, to overwhelm its opponents come the spring. The German army grew conspicuously larger during the months after September 1939. Drafting 4 million factory workers into the army at the war's beginning and diverting railway transport from coal deliveries to troop movements inevitably hit arms production during the war's early months. By May, however, German arms production was undergoing its single greatest increase for the whole war. The efforts of the Army Procurement Office ensured that civilians' needs were subordinated to those of the Wehrmacht. This was not enough to save the Army Procurement Office from being swallowed up by the new Ministry for Ammunition, established under Dr. Fritz Todt in March 1940. The new ministry, headed by a man more heedful of the needs of business than of those of the Wehrmacht, was a serious new rival to Lieutenant General Thomas's Office of Economics and Armaments at the OKW. But the Army Procurement Office had already laid the groundwork for the expanded armament drive. Among other things, the increase in panzer manufacture enabled the army to double the number of panzer divisions. The number of infantry divisions increased by 60%. The single most pressing armaments-related concern during the war's first months was ammunition. Hitler gave particular priority to howitzers and heavy mortars, ordering a rise in production by the autumn of 1940 to 3 million light howitzer shells, 650,000 rounds of heavy howitzer ammunition, and more than 50,000 mortar bombs. The main suppliers of ammunition were Krupp, Klöckner, Vereinigte Stahlwerke, and the state-owned Reichswerke Hermann Göring. The heavy focus on artillery ammunition suggests that, confident though he was of his troops' superiority, Hitler was not envisaging a lightning victory in the spring either. The initial aims of the OKH planners certainly fell far short of defeating France outright. They merely wanted to drive downwards through the Low Countries, threaten Britain by capturing the Channel ports, and neutralize large numbers of Allied troops. The plan was shelved, partly because Belgium and the Netherlands were stepping up their mobilization, partly because of poor weather, and partly because a German officer crash-landed over Belgian territory carrying a briefcase stuffed full of staff maps outlining the plans. The plan Hitler eventually selected out of all the other replacement plans proffered has various names. The most famous is the Sickle-Cut Plan. It has also been named after the officer who took the most plaudits for devising it, Lieutenant General von Manstein. Manstein can plausibly lay claim to having been Germany's most operationally gifted general of the Second World War. He was also another practiced self-publicist, who later inflated his role in devising the plan. He should, in fact, share credit with several other officers, such as Major General Kurt von Tippelskirch of Army Intelligence. The plan found favor with Hitler because of its imagination and daring, qualities, of course, that the German officer corps had long sought to nurture among its members. The first phase of the plan entailed General von Bock's Army Group B, which comprised 29 divisions, including 3 panzer and 2 motorized infantry divisions, attacking through the Netherlands and Belgium. To a large extent, this thrust would be retracing the steps of the German attack through Belgium in August 1914. Manstein and his fellow planners anticipated the Allies advancing northwards to meet it. But this attack was to be a feint. The main effort was to come from General von Rundstedt's considerably stronger Army Group A, with its 35 infantry divisions, 7 panzer divisions, and 4 motorized infantry divisions. It was to attack in the sector that Allied High Command had overlooked the most, the Ardennes region of eastern Belgium and Luxembourg. The Ardennes comprised hilly, forested terrain of a sort the Allied High Command did not believe the panzers could penetrate. It therefore paid no serious attention to the danger of attack from that direction. That said, the sickle-cut plan was undoubtedly an immense gamble, for successfully moving a large armoured force through such terrain demanded exceptionally effective logistical planning. Furthermore, to ensure a realistic chance of a breakthrough, such a formidable panzer force was needed that the plan's final form did not leave a single panzer division in reserve. The officers who devised the plan believed that, risky though it was, a breakthrough was possible if surprise could be achieved and the panzer division's movement and supply properly coordinated. This would enable the Wehrmacht to start cutting across the rear of the Allied armies advancing northwards into Belgium to counter Army Group B. The main panzer thrust would be in the direction of Sedan. At the very start of the offensive, the Luftwaffe would strike at Allied organization on the ground, then support the ground offensive by targeting Allied reinforcements and fortifications, and by supporting river crossings. Once a breakthrough was achieved, a follow-up phase would see the weight of the German offensive switched back to a reinforced Army Group B, which would then break through north of the rivers Meuse and Sambre. The sickle-cut plan received strong support from General von Rundstedt. Rundstedt's enthusiasm reflected not just his own army group's allotted starring role, but also his appreciation that panzers had great potential if used in the right way. In February, the plan also received strong support from Hitler. Hitler's backing signified not just the sound strategic insight he sometimes displayed, but also his gambler's instinct. Later that month, the OKH drafted an operational directive based on the sickle-cut plan, codenamed Case Yellow. Yet neither the sickle-cut plan itself nor its follow-up phase were devised with total victory in mind. The best the Germans hoped to achieve was to secure the Low Countries, northeast France, and the northern coast of the English Channel, destroying a significant portion of the Allied armies in the process. Even Manstein and his fellow planners did not expect the attack to be as decisive as it was. That it eventually defeated the Allies so emphatically was due to a multitude of Allied weaknesses as well as German strengths. The Allies' strategy during the months before the campaign in the West did have some sense behind it. The French had their reasons for not extending the Maginot Line along the Franco-Belgian border to the English Channel. The soft ground along the border was ill-suited to deep fortifications. Northeast France was a major industrial region over which the French did not want to have to wage a pitched defensive battle, and it would hardly help French efforts to cultivate Belgium if an enormous line of fortifications separated the two countries. For Belgium, though officially neutral since 1936, figured prominently in French war plans. The Allies expected the Germans to come through the Low Countries. The Germans, so Allied military planners surmised, would view the Low Countries as a potential route into France unhindered by the Maginot Line, and as a potential site for coastal bases from which they could threaten southern England. The French hoped not only that any German invasion through the Low Countries would propel Belgium and the Netherlands firmly into the Allied camp, but also, most crucially, that the Belgians would be able to hold it along the fortified line of the Albert Canal and Deal River. This would enable the French to bring up reinforcements, including strong motorized forces, to support the Belgians and halt the German attack. With the Germans firmly held, the Allies could then marshal their superior resources, aided by the United States, for the kind of long war that the Germans would be unable to withstand. In many ways, this was a reasonable plan. But while a German invasion through the Low Countries was an obvious possibility, Allied planners' fixation on it blinded them to less obvious, more dangerous possibilities elsewhere. General Gamelin made matters worse in the wake of the capture of the German staff maps in Belgium, which seemed further to confirm that the Germans were planning exactly the kind of northern offensive the Allies were anticipating. As it was, the Germans were still undecided over the direction their offensive should take before deciding on the sickle-cut plan soon after. Oblivious to this, Gamelin decided to take the Allied Deal plan to its logical extreme by committing the French 7th Army to an advance as far as Breda, just north of the Dutch-Belgian border. This, Gamla reasoned, would reassure the British that the entire Channel coast was secure, and would enable the French to control the Belgian and Dutch armies more closely. The Seventh Army contained a large number of motorized units, units that were now being committed even further away from the sector where they would be needed most. As for that sector, the Allies also missed warning signs of German intentions in and west of the Ardennes. Allied, particularly French, intelligence officers failed to convey details of the unusually high number of reconnaissance flights the Germans made over the area west of Sedan, just east of the Ardennes, during the weeks prior to the offensive. Much of the blame for this lay in a French military culture that isolated and undervalued intelligence officers, failed to heed their warnings, and discouraged them from making such warnings more loudly. Then again, assessing the Germans competently would have been breaking an Allied habit, for both British and French intelligence services had also consistently overestimated the strength of the Wehrmacht during the late 1930s. Among other things, the intelligence chief for General Alphonse-Joseph Georges, French commander of the northeastern sector of the front, believed the Germans had somewhere between 7,000 and 10,000 tanks, well in excess of the 2,400 the Germans actually possessed. The fear such miscalculations created could only make Allied generals even more cautious once the Germans attacked. Misreading the Germans' intentions, while a lamentable error, was not necessarily sufficient to seal the Allies' fate in the coming campaign. But Allied High Command and the forces it led all suffered further debilitating flaws. Though there was friction between the OKH and the OKW, at least both bodies were of the same nationality. The Inter-Allied Command, however, was dysfunctional. For example, Lord Gort, commander of the BEF, was not only operationally subordinate to General Georges, but politically subordinate to the British government in London. The problems were not just organisational. Lord Gort, his many admirable qualities notwithstanding, had been promoted beyond his abilities. General Gamelin was a not especially robust 68-year-old who, as well as concocting the misconceived Deal Breda plan, would prove ineffective almost to the point of passivity during the course of the campaign. More generally, senior officers in the French army were on average 8 to 10 years older than their German counterparts. Both the French and British armies suffered from an overly rigid, inflexible command system, which allowed subordinates far less discretion to react quickly to events than German subordinate commanders enjoyed. British command also suffered from the painful effects of the transformation the British Army was undergoing from a small peacetime force, whose combat experience since 1918 had consisted almost entirely of suppressing colonial revolts, to a much larger wartime one. Of the British Army's three staff colleges, only one was in the UK. There was no senior staff college or combined services college, and the need to build up a body of staff officers quickly for war work compelled staff colleges to teach only the essentials. The contrast with German general staff training, whatever its own flaws, was immense. It is little wonder that the operational doctrine that emerged from this professional environment fell far short of the challenges the German invasion would present. The staggering death tolls the British and French armies had suffered in their offensives on the Western Front between 1915 and 1917 had impelled both military establishments towards defensive warfare. In 1940, the French High Command believed that the key to success on the battlefield was to control operations rigidly and deploy unassailable defensive firepower. An attacking force, it believed, would break against such an obstacle. French generals were so convinced of this that they gave little thought to what they would do if the enemy did break through. The most they did was to place strong points behind the main defense line. They did not consider the possibility that the enemy might bypass and isolate these also. A similarly sclerotic defensive mentality hobbled British military thinking. During the interwar years, moreover, economic woes and a backlash against militarism had hit investment in the British armed forces. And such was Britain's need to defend the empire that such investment as it did commit to rearmament was channeled predominantly into the Royal Air Force and Royal Navy. The British military as a whole considered the First World War to have been a traumatic event, but believed that there was no need to heed the lessons it had generated as to how a major continental European war might be fought in the future. A deferential culture within the British Army discouraged officers from criticizing the conventional wisdom. On this score, as on others, the contrast with the German army's approach could not have been plainer. Tank for tank, British and French armoured forces in the spring of 1940 outnumbered those of the Germans. Indeed, the French alone had more tanks than the Germans, with about 3,000 to the Germans' 2,400. The German Mark I's and Mark II's, comprising about 5/8 of the Panzer force, were already obsolescent. The Germans' main workhorse during the Western campaign would be the Mark III, but even this was less well protected than the British Mark II and the French Saumur, the latter of which was an outstanding medium tank. The most formidable tank that would be employed by either side during the campaign was the French Char B. Only the German Mark IV could match this. At least the Germans had narrowed the numerical gap by the spring of 1940, however. The number of Mark III's had risen from 151 in September 1939 to 785 in May 1940, the number of Mark IV's from 247 to 381. Where the Germans clearly outdid the Allies was not in the size of their armoured force, but in how they organised and deployed it. Only a few French officers, such as Colonel Charles de Gaulle, gave proper thought to armoured warfare doctrine. The French army lacked proper armoured, that is, tank divisions, until early 1940, and even then only two would be fully operational by the time the Germans invaded in May. The French army did possess motorised divisions and light mechanised divisions. However, the motorised division's allotted role was simply to proceed swiftly to the front line should the Germans attack through Belgium. The light mechanised divisions were merely equipped to fan out and provide cover for defending or attacking infantry, as cavalry had done in wars past. Neither type of division had anything remotely approaching the kind of armoured punch needed for a heavy attack and a sustained advance. The BEF, meanwhile, contained only one armoured division and little clue how to use it. British military planners failed to grasp the importance of combined arms operations in the way the Germans did. They saw tanks as a separate weapon rather than one that could be integrated with other arms branches. The British Army's parochial regimental system did not help matters. Moreover, the British viewed tanks from a cavalryman's perspective, and like cavalry, they developed light tanks for raiding and reconnaissance, and heavier tanks for counter-attacking. What the British lacked, and what the Germans increasingly did not lack, was a quality all-purpose tank. British military intelligence also assumed, wrongly, that the Germans would deploy their panzers in penny packets, just as they had deployed their storm troops during the First World War. The state of the Allied infantry also provided little comfort. The BEF was mainly an infantry force lacking supporting arms and, its 25-pounder guns aside, saddled with too much obsolescent artillery. Moreover, as it sought to expand its strength to 10 divisions with new formations hurriedly shipped over from Britain, it became heavily reliant upon reservist territorial divisions. By the time the Germans attacked, these divisions had still not completed their training, and the BEF as a whole had had no time to practice combined arms training or properly examine the reasons for German victory in Poland. Moreover, tactical training was much more centralized, and therefore much more rigorous, in the German army than in the British. Among other things, British officer cadets did not learn platoon tactics anything like as thoroughly as their German counterparts. At least the BEF was making an effort, however hurried and flawed, to train up its infantry. The French army, however, did not set about this particular task with anything like the necessary urgency. It allotted the infantry a centrally important role, but did not allot the new infantry recruits the training to match. The year's training of French infantry conscript usually received was not enough for him to master all the necessary skills. During the Drôle de Guerre, the French failed to address this defect, and the troops grew lethargic as a result. One German officer visiting the front even wrote of the fraternization he witnessed in certain sectors. "I once drove along the west wall from Karlsruhe all the way to the bend of the River Rhine at Basel, and in front of various positions I witnessed how German and French soldiers were chatting like buddies across the river." The French army leadership justified its slackness with the argument that it need only hold the Germans' initial attack and thereby give the French government enough time to mobilize the entire nation. But while the French infantry alternately fraternized and ossified, the Germans interspersed their fraternizing with intensive retraining. After its infantry's uneven performance in Poland, the German army embarked upon a massive retraining program. The army contained 4.5 million men in 1939, but only 1.3 million were in active duty units, and only 647,000 of the army's reservists were fully trained. After the Polish campaign, however, the army initiated crash courses that placed particular stress on crossing rivers and attacking fortifications. Further such courses for officers were run at Königsberg, passing out 300 officers a time at 3 to 4 week intervals. The German army also received an injection of younger personnel following the Polish campaign. These men were transferred from industry in exchange for older army personnel to spread the burden of military service across age groups. Not all the results of this training program were satisfactory. Among other things, the solitary Waffen-SS unit that had fought in the Polish campaign, the LAH, had not distinguished itself especially, and the training of Waffen-SS units for the upcoming campaign in the West made an ominous impression. In April 1940, an officer from Army Group B visited the SS motorized regiment at Sennelager. He reported that, despite the regiment's undoubtedly high-quality manpower, the combat training of the non-commissioned officers and men of the SS is inadequate. It will cost a lot of blood. Perhaps the most glaring contrast of all was in the two sides' air forces. The French Armée de l'Air was in a belated state of transition in the spring of 1940. What this meant, practically, was that it lacked enough new aircraft and enough trained pilots to fly them when the Germans attacked. The RAF had benefited from greater investment than its French counterpart during the previous 2 years, but it denied the BEF a great deal of air cover in order to ensure that Britain itself was defended. Against this paltry opposition, the Germans could commit technically advanced aircraft and crews with a high level of training, and now experience. The Allies had no equivalent to the Stuka, an aircraft that, while not infallible, was formidable when it had the first-rate Messerschmitt ME-109 fighter protecting it. Furthermore, Luftwaffe and German army commanders felt far more unity of purpose than their Allied counterparts. This was partly because of the inter-service cooperation they had been practicing since the Spanish Civil War, and partly because several topmost Luftwaffe commanders, such as General Albert Kesselring, originally hailed from the army. The OKH also sought to tighten up air-ground coordination following the Polish campaign. It placed particular importance on aerial reconnaissance against fortifications and roadblocks, and on concentrated and coordinated anti-aircraft fire. It also placed special value on the Fieseler Storch aircraft as a reconnaissance tool. The first grievous blow the Germans landed upon the Allies in 1940 came not in France and the Low Countries, but in Norway. Both the Allies and the Germans had an interest in this country. Germany relied heavily upon iron ore from neutral Sweden, and Hitler sought to secure its supply by forestalling any Allied attempt to occupy Norway. This would also bring further economic resources and coastal bases under German control. To secure Norway, the Germans would also need to seize Denmark so that the Luftwaffe could conduct operations over Norway from Danish air bases. Operation Weserübung, Weser exercise, the invasion of Denmark and Norway, commenced on 9 April. Though the OKH had largely planned the invasion of Poland, the invasion of Denmark and Norway was an inter-service trifibious operation under the aegis of the OKW. The OKW gave a decidedly mixed account of itself before and during the campaign, yet its performance proved far superior to that of the British and French forces. The invasion of Denmark went smoothly. German troops landed at Copenhagen and other cities, and paratroop formations of the Luftwaffe seized Danish airfields. Swiftly, grudgingly, and rather understandably, considering the impossible odds it faced, the Danish government acquiesced in German demands to occupy the country. Its decision was considerably expedited by German promises to allow the Danish government a degree of freedom that would prove unique by the standards of Nazi-occupied Europe. Invading Norway with a trifibious operation, however, was a complex challenge. Transporting, supplying, and protecting a force of even modest size required virtually all of Germany's still diminutive fleet of surface warships. It was also an undertaking under serious threat from the Royal Navy. Weser-Ubung aimed to land troops at five different points along the Norwegian coast, where they would seize key population centres and port facilities. Such was the country's geography, however, that the landings had to be made at disparate points that the troops would be unable mutually to reinforce. Nor did the German onslaught cow the Norwegians in the way the OKW had hoped. Indeed, Norwegian troops put up spirited resistance in places. However, once the Germans had secured all major population centres, military headquarters and supply bases, the Norwegians could only half-mobilise. Central